She has sung with the St. Louis Municipal Opera, the New York City Opera, and the NBC TV Opera. She has done some film work also, most recently in Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood. Other stage roles include Nurse Ratched in the San Francisco production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Domina in the original Broadway and film version of A Funny Thing Happened to Me on the Way to the Forum. And of course, she is now playing Miss Hannigan, director of the Girls' Orphanage in Annie. By the way, next Thursday's performance will mark the 1,000th performance of Annie, and Annie is scheduled to run at the Forest Theater through September 7th. Welcome to Fresh Air, Ruth. And I have to tell you that your performance in Annie was really the highlight of the show for me.
Thank you. Thank you.
In Annie, your first appearance as Miss Hannigan, it just exudes evil. It's a comic role and an evil, and has its moments of comedy, but there is a real evil presence there. Do you feel that on stage when you're exuding it in the audience? What's going through you emotionally at points like that?
No, I must tell you, from the very beginning of my, quote, career, which began late, in, according to some people's standards, I didn't go into theater until I got out of college. I had trained, I suppose, to be a teacher. I really wasn't quite of this world then. I was in a cloud somewhere. But I fell in with a group that was doing, all worked around one accompanist. At the time, I had majored in music in school, and we were going to produce Hansel and Gretel on weekends in the summer. In English, and I was going to be the witch, and I put $18 in the kitty, as everybody else did, and since I knew how to type, I did the PR. But I must tell you that it was like playing in the attic on a rainy day for me. It had the quality of performing. I had no idea what it was, except I was having a great time. And then to get the feedback that was so tremendous, and my instincts, which have always played a big part in my work, were to make the witch evil and yet silly. She happened to like to eat cookies made out of children, but that there wasn't a sense of evil in that for her, because it was just wasn't. So in a way, she was a cartoon character, but her reality was still very real. She was hungry, and that's what she planned to eat. And she was very mean to the children, and she thought she was all power. It was all the things that Miss Hannigan is. It was all the things that Nurse Ratched was, at different levels. But all human people, human characters, overlaid with evil, sense of humor, whatever it is they wanted, and how they proposed to get it.
So at those moments on stage when you say things like, "you rotten orphan," and it's there, like, is that sort of a whole complex of emotions you're feeling?
No, she's a rotten orphan. She got me out in the middle of the night running away again. That's all. It's not evil. She's evil. I'm good.
Okay, thanks for clarifying. Your role is a mix of comedy and evil.
Mm-hmm.
How did that evolve? And was your original concept of the role, did that change the balance between that? What was it originally?
I originally played her almost straight. I had come back from straight theater, which I had wanted to do very much. And I played her, even play her straight now. That is that she, everything she does, yes, I use shtick, and yes, I milk moments. But hopefully all within the context of a real person whom I consider, and everybody else considers, quite idiotic at times. But she has evolved from and she's still evolving. That's what I love about her. She's very livable. I don't think I could stay on the road 2.5 years and think about another year doing it without having someone that I enjoyed playing. So that I would say it took me 6 months to get her where I really wanted her, and then refine.
Are most of the roles you've played subject to evolution like that?
Yes, but the problem in, let's say, in rep theater, which you mentioned, or even in opera, is that you never get enough performances to really get what you want. And then the challenge, once you get what you want, is to recreate it every night as though it's fresh.
The production of Annie that you're in now is a touring production, and it's followed a fairly successful Broadway Annie. Did you feel burdened as you started the play by preconceptions of how things were played?
In the case of Dorothy Loudon, who had, as you know, won a Tony for her portrayal, I hadn't seen her work, But the thing that Charnin has kept, that's Martin Charnin, whose idea, who born the idea, birthed the idea of Annie, and then wrote the book and directed it, that he, his approach, there are no two companies that are the same, because he insists that, no, that we not play it, not we not imitate anybody else, but that we play it as we're going to play it, and then he will tell us where he finds the positive things and take off from there. And that's the way I've been handled. And I think Norwood Smith the same, and certainly Mary Kay.
The cast does feature seven young actresses playing the orphans,
right,
at the orphanage, which you officiate at. How is it to work with kids? Are there any differences between working with kids and the seasoned professionals of the theater that you're...
Well, you have to know that these kids have been pretty much... These kids are not allowed to do anything but what they're doing.
What are some of the limits that they have to respect?
They have to... Their timing has to be the same. Everything with them has to be the same. Now, within... They're always asked for more reality and more listening to each other. We all are. You get into lousy habits playing a long run. But the kids do not vary. I can vary. Other people in the cast can vary with timing. But if you vary your timing with a child who's been going a certain way, You throw the scene, and then they start to giggle, and then they get, because that's all the further they're allowed to venture into, quote, acting. Mary Kay, on the other hand, is quite instinctively able to take changes in variety.
Mary Kay plays Annie.
Mary Kay Lombardi plays Annie in this company. And I'm not denying that the other children can and do and have taken things that I've tossed to them very well, but I cannot consciously say, I'm going to try this tonight. You've got to give them what they expect. And then they will feed back.
Do you spend much time with them off stage?
Yeah, sometimes in some cities more than others. There are cities where they live closer to me backstage. Here I deal with them because we finish scenes frequently together, and we deal with the elevator together. And, of course, before the show we gather together, checking in and so forth. But some, I spend more time with some than with others, as we do with all friends anywhere.
How about just the entire cast in general? Do you feel like not really being around other... You need your space off stage?
Well, yes, we all pretty much claim our space. I'm very fortunate to have a private dressing room, whereas your ensemble people frequently are thrown into situations where they are together morning, noon, and night. But it's a wonderful company. It's a family, and we're very supportive of each other and very caring. This road experience, first of all, the cast is so wonderful, and secondly, because we have more frequent openings than New York has, we are demanded to reach a certain kind of level again for a new opening, because those press, those reviews are important, and because there are new, and just because that's the way Charnin feels, this thing needs a shot in the arm. Therefore, we at least twice a year, when there are contract changes, spring and fall, where they're apt to be contracting, or any other major changes in the cast, there is a reevaluation, and that's also marvelous. So it's not just a thing frozen in time. It is allowed to change.
Another role that you played for a fairly long time, a year and a half, is Nurse Ratched,
yeah,
in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, yeah, a production that was produced in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Now, that's a really hateful role.
Yeah. Well, again, I can't play a role that I don't care about.
What did you find in Nurse Ratched?
I found Nurse Ratched frighteningly close to me, in that, not that I'm necessarily evil, but I could understand her, in that she felt she was doing right. And if I played her like she felt she was doing right, she wasn't evil, except in other people's eyes. Everything she did was so wrong. She was so sure. She probably hadn't cracked a book in 10, 12 years. She had been able to survive in a system that's not easy to survive in. That is in the mental hospital
setting.
That's,
yeah,
right. And then institutional setup, and had a certain amount of clout and a certain amount of position, which she maintained. But she felt that everything she was doing was right.
Can I ask what you learned about Nurse Ratched, and like if it was like the same type of 6-month process of?
Yes. I was very fortunate. The parts that I have, I feel, done the best, and Nurse Ratched was one of them, along with Annie, is that I had a lot of help along the way in establishing the role. I played in a small theater in San Francisco called The Little Fox, which had a thrust stage and seated about under 400. So that you, and you, it was an intimate production by that, and also it was a production that drew people in, as opposed to a proscenium production like New York, the New York production, original New York production of the show. So that you were really involved. It was almost like having a gallery in a medical school, but there was no glass in front of those people. They were really involved with relationships and the terrible things that were, and also the humor. The humor was so ridiculous, and you had to have humor or you would all go out and cut your throats.
Did you research it in any way, your role?
No, I wasn't able. I came into the show again late. I was working ACT, and at a time when I was not working ACT, there was an opening in the production. I had seen the production, and I came out saying, I've got to play this role sometime, because I thought it was fascinating. What was the question?
If you had done any research, did you go to any hospital?
No, they had gone to a hospital, and... But I was, by comments of people who, nurses and people who had worked in those institutions to me later, discovered that what I felt about her was right on. And so that I, from my own life, discovered I had experiences that showed me what she was like and how she would react.
Did you find in the relationship that you have with McMurphy, who was the lead character played by Jack Nicholson in the movie, and Billy, the young boy who stuttered, and it was a fairly emasculating relationship between Nurse Ratched and Billy, and got pretty intense towards the end. Did you find that this intensity had to be compensated for offstage, or did you see my...
Yeah, well, that was a very tight company, because we played in that off-Broadway situation, then you have a theater whose dressing rooms are you're living together. You're on top of each other, literally, the whole evening. And luckily for me, I had people that I loved as people, plus this great help from the stage manager who was able to sit out front. The light booth in that theater was out front, so he not only called his lighting cues, but was able to make his notes on my work from an audience point of view.
Give you some feedback.
And that's, yeah. And that was wonderful.
You've done it, like, with the ACT in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Many stage roles, which I'd imagine would be quite different from musical comedy roles. Are there any essential differences you can share with us?
No, I think any one of those shows that I played in could be set to music. And I don't mean it just has to be an opera. There are monologues that are arias, literally. But I found I did take a great deal of my musical training and background with me, and luckily Bill Ball, who is the director of that company, feels the same way about music and talks in musical terms, so that you have a shape to scenes, you have a beginning, a middle, and an end, you have loud and soft, your forte, your pianissimo, you have arias that with great stretch of voice. Now, to do all this and keep it within the realm of theater and not make it sound as, you know, as we're analyzing it, so that you mask some of that, or I'm looking for a word that I can't find, but you give it meaning. There's a reason for your saying things in that way, not just music. But that musical background was a tremendous value to me.
Are there is there a type of liberty or flexibility that you can take in one case you can't take?
Yes. Exactly. Certainly the most stringent and most tight is the opera, where your spoken lines are usually, they're accompanied, recitative, or the parlando things, where they are within given, and you have to take that beat from your conductor. You go into musical comedy, your scenes are played as theater, and are directed as theater, but your music is still, you have someone there telling you what to do.
Yeah, there's outside timing.
That's right.
Post.
That's right. And that's, I think, possibly why I wanted to go to straight theater. I wanted to, first of all, I wanted to know the craft better, and secondly, I wanted the opportunity to time be my own conductor.
How about the types of direction that you'd get? You said that while at ACT, the direction spoke to your musical understanding. But is there any differences between the type of direction, either regarding timing or blocking or interpretation of a role or whatever, between a non-musical stage role and a musical comedy role?
Yes, the musical comedy is you can't take the time with musical comedy that you can take with theater. It just isn't, unless it's a very, very unusual production.
Do you get more into interpretation of the character in one setting than in the other, or is there,
well,
depending on production?
Depending on production. Usually, in rep theater, for me, there was never enough time. There was never enough time to prepare the show, and never enough time to play it. But it was a stretching of a lot of muscles that I didn't have, and so it had a great value for me in touching base with all those things. I felt in coming back to Annie, which was I had done a revival of How to Succeed in 75, and I had done something in St. Louis in 76, but mainly I'd been in theater now for about 14 years and done very little, if any, singing. So that I came back with a whole fresh, reinvigorated approach and much more confidence in my craft, myself, my own craft, than I ever had before. And luckily, he touched base with a director who was willing to let me plumb all those things, not just take his readings.
When considering a role, reading across scripts, or however you evaluate what your next experience is going to be, what's attractive about a role? What do you look for in a role?
Depth, conflict, humanity, problems, not just kind of cardboard characters, people with problems.
Do they have to be problems that you've had, problems or problems that you can relate to, not narratively?
Well, yes, preferably. I mean, I've never been in a concentration camp. I mean, there are many things I have not suffered in my life, and I don't mean conflicts as suffering, but just so that there's something interesting to deal with in a subtext.
Are there roles that you'd like to do sometime in the future?
I don't know. I've heard people say, oh, you should do Medea, and you should do Elizabeth of Mary, you know, Mary Queen of Scots or whatever. I would love to portray I don't know, people out of history, I think. I really don't have that kind of drive to do this and that role before my time, in my lifetime. I feel that the roles will come to me, and everyone is not going to be the plum that Annie is, but that given those opportunities, I'd just like to keep working at them.
Can I ask you if you have anything to share about working with Zero Mostel?
Yes, you mentioned Zero before. It was a marvelous experience. Marvelous experience. He's a man that was that could play any given scene a dozen different ways, and they were all valid. They were brilliant. On his good nights, he touched the stars. I didn't work opposite Z. I worked opposite Davy Burns, who was a whole other kind of marvelous comedic talent, but who worked by the book and worked had his own set of rules, which were impeccable, were clean, wonderful, wonderful timing, and a great humanity to his work. But I played Davy's wife in the show, and that was I must correct you. I did not do the film of A Funny Thing. I did the film of How to Succeed.
I see. Well, thanks.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
I just don't want someone out there to say you said and I didn't. I deny.
Okay. Well, tell me if I'm correct in this. You did play in Dirty Harry.
I did play in Dirty Harry, which was filmed in San Francisco,
right, and produced by Clint Eastwood. Clint, tell us about your role first, so
we
can remember you.
Yeah, you have to know that most of the casting on the when they film in San Francisco, most of the major casting is done in Hollywood. Then minor roles are picked up in San Francisco, and I was a casting lady named Nessa Hyams at that time picked me as a possibility, and so I was interviewed, and my first question they said was, can you drive? And I said, sure, I can drive. Well, they said, there's this bus. I said, I can't drive it. Well, this goes on and on. But at any rate, I was in another show at the time and stealing out to do this film and coming in dog-tired at night, and everybody said, why are you so tired? And I couldn't tell because this is almost a no-no. My bosses knew, but nobody else was to know. At any rate, it was a hijacking of a school bus before Chowchilla, right? Before school buses were ever hijacked. Which is kind of amazing that someone came up with this idea, that this nut who was sniping at everyone in running from the law spotted a school bus, got himself on there, and pulled a gun and took over the bus.
How much time did you spend with Clint Eastwood in doing this?
I spent almost no time with Clint as an actor. I spent some time in passing as a producer. He wears two caps in those occasions, and he was marvelous. He was very, very, very warm, very businesslike. Occasionally, I would see him at lunch. We'd have lunch out on the location. But I would love to have done another thing. And, of course, when they did sequels to that, to the story of that cop, Dirty Harry, nobody was allowed to repeat. There was to be different people in the cast.
It's funny, one of the, I think it's becoming better known that Clint Eastwood is not the person that Dirty Harry is off the movie screen, and that that is a surprising revelation to a lot of people. Because he has such a strong image in his Dirty Harry films. Can I ask you if you're a fan of not only Dirty Harry films, but of other sort of loner detective action type?
Yeah, but not any given one in particular. I don't search them out. I don't read detective stories. Let's put it that way. I like all kinds of film if it's successful in what it's doing. Clockwork Orange struck me as just incredible. Not only the way it was done, but what it projected was going to be, and it was true. But done artistically, all the white, the milk white sets in that coffee house,
and the use of music.
Yeah, and the makeup on the kids, and the terrible things they did.
When you were doing Dirty Harry, did you have very much of a sense of what the film was going to be like as you were doing it, or is it just a sense of your own little bits and pieces, which?
Well, I was given a story because I had a rub with the villain. I was allowed to read the script, yes, so that I knew what was happening. And but we were given no. Don Siegel doesn't work in any let's say actor studio way. You just simply play your scenes.
Well, you're now, of course, playing Miss Hannigan in Annie, and. Do you have a chance to see Philadelphia much? You've been here for a while, but
been here for a while. I see it in bits and pieces. As a rule, my first part of the week I go to New York. Excuse me. So that leaves me Thursdays and Fridays, and if I have time, then I love to walk. So I try to combine the walking with the sightseeing. I still want to get back to the Rodin Museum, which was something I saw as a teenager. Now this, I'm sure there are many other things here that have equal. Will have equal interest for me, but that's a sentimental journey.
Are you able to keep in touch with the people that you'd like to keep in touch with who aren't in Philadelphia, or is that reserved for after you finish Annie?
Well, I can't reserve. I get on the phone an awful lot because it's so easy in a life like this to lose track of time and to lose track of people. Who are important and whose continuity I need to sustain me too.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for coming here. I've been speaking with Ruth Cobart, and she's now playing the role of Miss Hannigan in the production of Annie, which is at the Forest Theater. It's there through September 7th, and this Thursday will mark the 1,000th performance. Of Annie. Thanks again for coming here.
Thank you, I loved it.
Right now, let's hear something from Annie. This won't be Ruth Cobart, but it will be the role that Ruth Cobart is now playing in Annie. And the name of this number is Little Girls, and it helps to illustrate what Ruth Cobart's character feels about little girls.
Little necks, surely I will get an acquittal. fresh little bloomer. I'd have cracked years ago if it weren't for my sense of humor. Someday I'll step on their freckles. Some night I'll straighten their curls. Send the FUD, send the FU, anything that you can do.
Little Girls, that was performed by Dorothy Loudon in the role of Miss Hannigan. Just a few moments ago, I was speaking with Ruth Cobart, who is playing Miss Hannigan in the touring production of Annie, now at the Force Theater in Philadelphia. It's about 26 minutes to 5 o'clock. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Now we're going to switch shows from Annie to Fiddler on the Roof, because in just a few moments, my guest will be Herschel Bernardi, now playing Tevye in the production of Fiddler on the Roof. And this is Herschel Bernardi.
The old country. Here's a horse cart. There's a wood stove. Here people work and struggle and starve a little and get sick and get married and give birth and raise children and fight with each other and laugh and cry and live and die. A tough people. They have to be. It's a tough life. But one thing holds them together. Makes them a community. Tradition. Who day and night must scramble for a living, feed a wife and children, say his daily prayers, and who has the right as master of the house to have the final word at home? The papa, the papa. Tradition, the papa. Who must know the way to make a proper home, a quiet home, a kosher home? Who must raise a family and run the home so Papa's free to read the holy book? The mama, the mama. Tradition, the mama. At 3 he goes to Hebrew school, at 10 he learns a trade. When Papa picks a bride for him, he hopes she's pretty. The sun, the sun. Tradition, the sun, the sun. Tradition. And who does Mama teach to mend and tend and fix, preparing her to marry whoever Papa picks?
The daughter, the daughter. Tradition, the daughter.
Herschel Bernardi singing a song from Fiddler on the Roof, Tradition. It's a song that I'm sure many people are familiar with. Joining me on Fresh Air now is Herschel Bernardi in Philadelphia playing Tevye, the leading role in Fiddler on the Roof. Herschel Bernardi has played Tevye for over 2 years, a total of over 700 performances. Tevye is a role which relates well to his background because he got his start as a child in Yiddish theater. Both of his parents were Yiddish theater veterans. Herschel Bernardi's other roles include Sholem Aleichem in The World of Sholem Aleichem,
I played Mendel the Book Peddler, which was a character invented by the author from a play called The World of Sholem Aleichem, which included works of Yitzchak Leib Peretz, or I.L. Peretz, and Sholem Aleichem, and folk tales. Thank you.
Good. Proceed.
Next.
Followed by Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, and he was in A Thousand Clowns, and Last of the Red Hot Lovers. Some of his films include Irma La Douce and Love with the Proper Stranger. On television, Herschel Bernardi starred in his own series, Arnie, and played Lieutenant Jacoby on Peter Jacoby. Gunn.
Jacoby.
Thank you. Okay, long O. He's also heard as the voice of Charlie the Tuna in the Tuna Should Taste Good, Not Have Good Taste commercials. Fiddler on the Roof is now at the Academy of Music through August 24th. Well, welcome to Fresh Air.
You scored 94.5.
Okay, then. That's Keep almost going. An A. In playing Tevye, does that relate to your own background very much, being that you were in Yiddish theater?
Not only does it relate to my background, I really, to a great extent, am playing my father. His character, meaning his emotional makeup, is very much like Tevye's, or was very much like Tevye's. So I remember much of that, and I instilled the part with a lot of his feelings. Not mine. I'm quite different. Herschel is, but I remember Papa, and I remember his gentleness, his ability to bend with the wind, which I don't do very well, and his understanding of his children, which I'm beginning to get.
Have you talked to with either relatives of yours, older relatives, or immigrants, or other people about shtetl life, people that may have memories of shtetl life?
Of course I have. I wanted to see more of the underlying seriousness, because the play does reflect some of Sholem Aleichem, but it still is Broadway musical comedy approach to that world, and I wanted to get more of the importance. For instance, the song, The Tradition. Usually, in the beginning, when it was first conceived, tradition was to explain to an audience what the hell the show is about, which is what it's about, the breakdown of tradition and love. That's those two things. And sometimes you throw that away, and it becomes a nice opening number. Even in my recording, I didn't understand it that well. I understand it much better today. And that is how important tradition was to those people in order to survive. And that was the essence. Today, when I do Tevye and we open the show, it is so important, it becomes the most important song in the show. I make it important. And that's what I discovered by these conversations with people from the old country, how important it was to keep a stability.
Do they have the urge to offer you critiques in your portrayal?
Mostly when they do, they don't. But when they do, it's always in like some of the Hebrew words and some of the dress, you know, the costume and so forth. And very little of that. It's quite authentic, this play.
What varies most from performance to performance? Are there things that surprise you at different points of the show?
Sometimes it depends on other actors, the audience. The audience has a lot to do with the performance.
How so?
It's a third eye. It's a love affair. If an audience, and I know that there are deceitful audiences, meaning there are audiences out for a good time, and they'll kid you along. They don't mean to, of course. This is all on the part of an actor's point of view. They will laugh uproariously at some jokes, and you'll be lulled into thinking that, boy, we've got a great audience tonight, meaning a receptive audience. What we're getting is people who really need to laugh. And they don't want to cry. And they don't want to have a bad time. Usually it's a Saturday night audience who's drunk. You know, or at least they've eaten a lot and they've drunk somewhat. And you begin to characterize people by their responses. And usually a Saturday night audience is an audience who will do a lot of laughing in the first act, a lot of coughing in the second. And then during the week, a serious audience will come and not laugh that much. But there will be a lot of sobbing in the audience toward the end. So, you know, it just varies. That has some effect on the performance. Although classically, it shouldn't, but it does. Other actors, depending on their amount of fatigue, how tired they are, generally speaking, and how excited they are that night, how much the adrenaline is flowing, that will determine the difference. But the play is essentially the same every night, except for these little differences.
It is essentially the same every night then, and you've performed it an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Does your perspective switch from... Well, let's see. In doing something over and over again, something which is really an art form, but it's done repetitively over and over again, night after night, do you have a switching perspective from this is something which is my art? And I'm not meaning to make that sound real heavy, but an art form, what you do, or something that, on the other hand, can just be your job?
Yes, it's both. It's absolutely both. I'm fortunate in this particular play. The content of this play means so much to me, to Hesh, to the guy, that I'm never failed to be moved by this play. I never fail to be moved. I mean, it's always, something in the play always moves me. If I take a look at The Fiddler and I see my people there, I just go to pieces. So there's no way I cannot be affected every night by the content. Usually, if you do a play, I did La Mancha, I did other plays that are art and they're marvelous, but after a while you say, well, here we go again. Where are the jokes? Because you have to use technique in order to keep it fresh. Here, I don't have to use technique that much. I just let it happen.
Are there parts of the production that require, a particular amount of concentration? Are there spots in the show that you're looking forward to getting over?
Yes, absolutely.
Could you share some of that?
That's a wonderful question. Yes, there are places in the play which are not very well written, which take an extra effort as an actor to overcome the lack of writing and the lack of even blocking, even the staging is a little crazy and cockeyed. So I don't look forward to those scenes. And when I finally get to them, we work harder on those scenes, really, and it's not the most pleasant experience. So we're happy when we get through with them. I won't tell you which scenes they are.
The show's been shown, seen, and produced pretty much all over the world.
75 countries.
What are the different countries that you've performed in?
I've only performed in the United States in Fiddler. I've done similar material in Canada, but that's about it.
Have you seen any of the other foreign productions?
Not only have I seen one, but one blew my mind. It was the Japanese production. It proved something to me which I was not conscious of, which the producers of this play were not conscious of when they produced it. And that is Fiddler on the Roof is by no means a Jewish play. It is appreciated by Jews for specific reasons because of customs, traditions, background, and heart, and even a pathological condition of Jews, which we can talk about later. But as a play, and the subject matter of the play is so universal, that one Japanese said to me, he said, "How could you do this in America? It's so Japanese." And the reason I saw it in Tokyo, the reason for it is the village life in Japan. They know nothing about Jews or Russians or Jews and Gentiles or the Bible. As a matter of fact, one of the guys who played the rabbi in that production, later I found this out, of course, that in rehearsal he came in with a prop, a crucifix around his neck. And the director says, no, these are Jews. He says, but it's the Bible, isn't it? And he says, no, it's another part of the Bible. Because in Japan it's Shinto and Buddha. So what we were faced with, or what they were faced with, was identifying this play with their lives. And what they found was that it is very close to village life in Japan, and especially after the war, after the Second World War, when the American conquerors came in and threw them out of their villages, one. Two, the industrial age forced prearranged marriages to be abandoned. Three, that they were poverty-stricken, and therefore they had to live a certain way to survive under American domination. And four, that the young girls would actually surgically round out their eyes so they could marry the American conqueror. And it was so close. The play was inadvertently so close to their lives.
Was the narrative kept the same?
It was identical to the American production. And they didn't care. They heard Jew, they heard Russian, they heard certain custom words that they had no identity.
Was it in English?
In Japanese.
Was it in Japanese, right.
They heard those words. You know, they were intact. You know, names like Anatevka was in the play. But the Japanese didn't care because the play was so close to their lives.
Did you meet many Jews in Japan?
No, except the European Jews. Yeah. There is one Japanese rabbi who was sent to the Union Theological Seminary here in the United States to try to convert Japanese people to Judaism, and it didn't work. So he has a congregation there, but they're all European.
How religious is the cast, the current cast of Fiddler?
If you look down the list of our cast, it's at least 60% Italian. I don't know how religious they are, but they are Italian. I guess some are Catholic. I know some are Buddhists. But as far as religion is concerned, I don't think there's much going on in the play.
How about in the Yiddish theater experience that you had?
Very little religion. Mostly culture and mostly just identity thing. No, the religion played a very small part. I played religious people, my folks and Yiddish actors. Let's put it this way. An actor in general is a gypsy. In general, he has an underworld mentality, a carny, as we say, a carny mentality. And anybody else are civilians. Anybody else is a civilian. As we said in the Yiddish theater, we call them private people because we were public people. I didn't know that until recently. That's why we called them private people. They did not participate in our lives. We lived in hotels, they lived in homes. To invite an actor to their homes was not accepted. We couldn't date. I mean, I was too young, but an actor could not date a private girl because they were disrespectable, unrespectable. Irrespectable? What's the word? Unrespectable?
Unrespected.
Unrespected. They were not respectable people. The actors were bums. So we had a reputation of being gypsies. And therefore we comply with the stereotype by becoming gypsies. And therefore lead what they would not consider respectable lives. We travel, we live in hotels, and we're kind of wild. And most important, I think, I mean, if you see the connection, most of our fans were of the underworld, gangsters in the old days, in the 30s. The 20s and the 30s, Yiddish theater, I remember what we called patrioten, or the people who really loved Yiddish theater, were racketeers and gamblers and gangsters, and we used to go to parties with them after the show.
And, of course, in New York, during the time of Yiddish theater, there was also an Italian theater, which...
It flourished.
Yeah, which flourished and resembled, in many ways,
very much.
The Yiddish theater of the time, and probably had the same similar importance to the community.
To the Italian community.
To the Italian community living there.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and about the Yiddish theater experience of your parents and how that led to your own experience?
Just what I said. I was traveling most of the time. I went to 26 different schools for specifically that reason. We never stayed in one place. And it was economic. Some cities we'd go to where the Jewish population was large and supported the theater, we'd stay for 3 to 6 months. Other places, a month was enough, and we'd move on. I was a true gypsy, and I was a new kid in school all the time.
Did you ever work with Molly Picon
yes.
in those days?
Well, I didn't work with her when I was a kid. I worked with her recently in concert. Yeah.
You also did some work in the Borscht Belt, in the Catskills. How does that relate to the Yiddish theater experience, in terms of audiences and what you were doing?
It's a direct outgrowth of the Yiddish theater.
You were a comic.
Well, I was a dramatic director, so I did comedy. I did anything you want. You name it, I did it. I made faces at the pool. And that's what a social director does. You just kind of keep people happy. I never saw the country. I saw the casino, the social hall in my room, and the pool sometimes. I'd hang around the pool.
Can I ask you to share any of your techniques for making people feel at home? Because it is a vacation.
You stick your finger in your nose and your ears, and you make faces, and you insult people, and you do things like that, which I didn't like too much. I didn't like that part of it. I would rather be in the casino and direct the shows.
How about you were driving a cab at that time, too? Was that a survival thing? Or
all of it.
Yeah.
All of it was in order to make a living so I could be an actor later on, or when it would happen. It didn't happen for a long time. I was an overnight sensation at the age of 35.
Is that from Shalom Aleichem?
No, it was Peter Gunn. That was when what we call a career really began. Shalom Aleichem got me into legitimate theater, as we say, because before that I was... like you say, the cab driver and the Borscht Belt. And also I did political theater. I did street theater, lots of street theater.
Who did you work with?
Henry Wallace. In 1948, I campaigned. I was part of the campaign for Henry Wallace, and we organized a lot of what they called caravans. We went across the country doing songs, dances, comedy, sketches, and what have you. So there was a really rich history in that during that period for me.
So let me get back to talking about the role of Tevye, which
sure.
you're currently doing in Fiddler. How much liberty do you take in the Tevye role in terms of creating your own Tevye?
Completely. All.
Is it something that changes from night to night mm-hmm. or it grows with you?
Yes, it's grown in the last, 15 years ago I did this, in 66 and 67, so I said 13 and 14 years. Then I did it again for a summer stock thing, and I'd grown older, and I'd understood it a little better. And because of those conversations we talk about, I did some research into the Jewish condition, as I call it, and learned a lot.
Can I ask you what made an impact on you so much that it would have changed your portrayal?
Yeah, anti-Semitism. The Arab world, the black world, the whole what I consider a critical situation for Jews generally in the world that is growing. It's not diminishing. It's growing. And it sounds paranoid, but, you know, the old joke is just because they're out to get you. I mean, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. So there is a consciousness on my part of anti-Semitism, peculiar forms of anti-Semitism that weren't there before. When I did Fiddler before, those forms were not as powerful as they are today. And they're much different than Christian anti-Semitism. There's Arabic anti-Semitism, there's black anti-Semitism, and it just goes on this way, which I became conscious of in the last 13 years, and I began to do some research in order to do a play. And during that research, I discovered certain things about myself, about my condition, and I use the word condition as opposed to my cultural identity. It is a condition, being Jewish.
Was it, did getting older have an impact on how you played the role?
Yes, very much.
Because Tevye is an older character.
Of course, less makeup. And well, just a deeper understanding of the character, because I was able to identify with him because I have three children that are grown now, when then they were infants, or not infants, they were young.
Okay, I won't pry. You've already warned me off. Well, let me ask you about some of your TV work. You had said that playing Lieutenant Jacoby had brought you really into a fairly high visibility. In general, has your association with television, or when you were most associated with television, has that helped or hindered your career as far as stage goes?
Oh, it's helped. There's no question that television and motion pictures reach that many more people, and depending on the quality of the reaching, that's how much it helps your theater career.
Do you have a what do you like about one type of setting in television, film, or stage?
What do I like about each one?
Yeah, what's attractive?
In the next 2 minutes, I can tell you. Theater, as I said before, is a love affair, so there's nothing to beat that. I can't beat that. That's for a 2-month-old infant that I am, applause is everything, or whatever response. So there's no question that that is my favorite form. Motion pictures, or rather, TV, tests my mettle a lot more as an actor, as a technician, because you have to know it right away. You got to be right there with it. You can't rehearse a month and figure it out. You have to be right, because you don't have time for rehearsal. You don't have the budget for it, let's put it that way. So that's kind of exciting. Commercials are even more so. In commercials, because I do a lot of voiceovers, that's where I really have to be tested, so to speak. So I come to a commercial session with everything flowing, ready to go, because I know I'm in trouble if I don't. It's that kind of a thing.
Well, let me ask you, for instance,
sure.
Charlie the Tuna,
yeah.
that commercial. I would think that, after all, it's what, maybe 30 seconds of copy that's eventually going to get on the air in the commercial. So wouldn't you have all day to get that right?
Oh, no, we do. At least 6 spots, at least. And because advertising agency executives by reputation are so hysterical and panicky and frightened, you have to contend with that more than you have to do with your own talent. That's really what the big blockage is on those sessions.
Do people come up to you and ask you to do Charlie the Tuna all the time?
Of course.
Well, unless you volunteered.
Oh, sometimes I do it gratuitously. As we finish this part of the show, I will say, and tell them Charlie sent you.
Okay, well, let me just ask you, what are your plans for Fiddler on the Roof?
My plans is what the plans of the play are, is to go for quite a while. This is an extended tour. It's a television tour. We call it a television tour because the ads are on television, which is very rare for a Broadway.
How does that influence the audiences? Because you are, for instance, the ads are appearing like with all the TV magazine morning magazine shows.
We are getting a TV audience. A lot of them have never seen a live play before, and it's wonderful.
Do you think that's broadening the audience in terms of the Jewish?
I think the producers makes it a big virtue. But I don't think he did it originally as a virtue. He did it as a moneymaker, and it is. But inadvertently, it is broadening the audience for live theater. No question about it.
Well, thanks very much for coming
pleasure,
this afternoon, Herschel. I've been speaking with Herschel Bernardi, who is now playing Tevye in the production of Fiddler on the Roof, now at the Academy of Music through August 24th.
August 24th, yeah.
Well, that just about does it for today's Fresh Air. Contributing to today's show has been Mumia Abu-Jamal. Production assistance was provided by Charles Hardy and Maeve McGorn, and technical supervision by Joyce Lieberman. My name's Danny Miller. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross. She's just about finished her vacation and will be back next Monday. And I hope you have a great evening. Bye. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening from National Public Radio. I'm Susan Stamberg in Washington.
And I'm Sanford Unger in New York, with All Things Considered.
Black newspaper called The Negro World. That in itself gave, and more than anything else, gave pride to black people. They were part of something important in the world.
Jamaica-born Marcus Garvey led the first important black power movement in this country in the 1920s. Tonight on All Things Considered, Garvey gets new recognition in Washington.
Also tonight, these stories from New York. President Carter holds a victory lunch and gives his first speech since being renominated. The big one comes tonight. John Anderson picks a Republican feminist to run his campaign.